this afternoon is Stuart Feuerstein, who is a professor in the Biological Sciences Department at Columbia University. He is a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and he's advisor to the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation Program for the Public Understanding of Science. He is the author of the book Ignorance, How It Drives Science, which came out with Oxford University Press in 2012, and the follow-up book, which is this one here, Failure, Why Science is So Successful. And both of these are excellent models for how to do good science writing for the public, and so I recommend them very much. So he'll be speaking to us, I think, a little bit about failure today as well. So please join me in welcoming Professor Feuerstein on Replicate That.
You, Alyssa, and thanks for organizing this and for the invitation and all the rest of it. And thank you for the plug as well. I certainly appreciate that. So I wrote this book on ignorance because I thought that we were too busy teaching our students about facts and this accumulation of facts and that they should memorize in science, and that really wasn't what scientists were mostly interested in. They were, it sounds almost trivial to say, but we don't teach it. They're mostly interested in what we don't know. So that book did okay, and then Oxford came along and asked me if I wanted to write another book, and I said, well, the only other thing I know about is failure, really, so I've kind of got this little niche for myself here. In any case, I want to use failure today and try and put a more positive spin on the word, if you will, give it a more positive sense in your mind, and so that we can then talk about replication failures. So, unfortunately, I'm going to start with this character here. Although he's like seems like a good guy these days, doesn't he? Remarkable, huh? So this is Donald Rumsfeld, of course, the Secretary of Defense at the time of the architect of two rather misbegotten adventures in the Middle East, Afghanistan and Iraq. And in a testimony to a Senate panel investigating his work there, he said, well, of course, there are a lot of things we don't know, and that's part of the problem, but that the real problem is there are also the unknown unknowns, the things we don't know, we don't know. And he was roundly ridiculed, actually, for this statement, but it's quite clever when you think of it. Fortunately, he didn't make it up. I looked long and hard to figure this out because I just couldn't stand giving him too much credit for this. So it actually, as far as I can tell, comes from a poem by D.H. Lawrence from 1917 called New Heaven and Earth, which is a rather long epic poem about sort of the transition from this life to the afterlife, if you will. And near the end of it, there's a stanza that goes, now here was I, new awakened, with my hand stretching out and touching the unknown, the real unknown, the unknown unknown. And so that's really the interesting thing is, if you're interested in ignorance, if you believe that science is about what we don't know, it's even more about what we don't know we don't know. That's the yet deeper kind of ignorance. And how do we get to that deeper sort of ignorance, that real unknown, if you will? And I would say the way we do that, actually, is through failure. That it's by failing pretty regularly, in fact, I'm going to suggest, that we find out that we didn't know something we didn't know. So we do an experiment because we don't know something, and then when the experiment fails, we realize that there's yet something deeper we didn't know, if you get my drift. I use a quote here from Benjamin Franklin, arguably America's first scientist, in which he suggested the history of errors or failures of mankind, all things considered, is more valuable and interesting than that of their discoveries because the truth is sort of narrow and uniform, but error endlessly diversified. In other words, you can screw up in like a lot of ways, right? And that's kind of true. I think it's sometimes called the Anna Karenina principle after Tolstoy, who once said that he wrote about unhappy families because happy families are all happy in pretty much the same way, but unhappy families have a million ways to be unhappy. I think what we can say is that we gain a great deal of knowledge through failures. I'll use one more quote here from the famous physicist Enrico Fermi, who's reported to have told his students that if you perform an experiment and it proves the hypothesis or confirms the hypothesis, you've made a measurement, but if it fails to confirm the hypothesis, you've made a discovery. Now, both of those things are important in science. Measurements are quite important, but discoveries are also quite important. And so whether you confirm or fail to confirm the hypothesis can be of equal value. All right, so without going too much further into this, because there's a whole book on it, obviously, let's say we agree that failure is not such a terrible thing. So it might be reasonable to ask how much failure. And I think it's a reasonable question to ask because I believe we often underestimate the amount of failure that would be acceptable. So I'll use a couple of examples. One from the natural world. So these guys here are all what we would call the top of the food chain, the kings of their various niches, the land, the sea, the air, whatever it is. And I suspect that most of us believe that anytime they get a little hungry, they just go out and bag themselves a snack, whether it's a rabbit or a deer or whatever. But in point of fact, if you go into the predator-prey literature, you find out that these guys are successful on approximately 7% or fewer of their trials, and that's generally around the edge of the herd as well. So they actually have a 93% failure rate. And yet they're the top of the food chain, their evolution's greatest achievement, as it were. So I think this is an example of where we underestimate the amount of failure that's acceptable and maybe even, in fact, necessary. Just because I'm in Boston and I'm from New York, I can't avoid this comparison and a kind of a baseball metaphor in which, of course, you know, two of the greatest hitters of all time, in point of fact, had failure rates of nearly two-thirds. So most of the time you go up to bat, you're out for one reason or another, and you get only hits about 30% of the time. And yet these guys, well, they didn't make it, but today players who had batting averages even vaguely close to these would be making over $10 million a year regularly. So failure pays. So the question is, can non-replication be a kind of a positive failure? Is it always a bad thing, or can it sometimes, in fact, be a useful thing? Once again, along these ideas, this idea of past mistakes, this is from Ernst Mayr in his wonderful book, I think they're both a biological thought. Only by going over the hard way by which these concepts were worked out, by learning all the earlier wrong assumptions that had to be refuted one by one, in other words, by learning all past mistakes, can one hope to acquire a really thorough and sound understanding. So in science, one learns not only by one's mistakes, but by the history of the mistakes of others, the failures of others and the failures of replication that in fact advance science. I'll talk about that a little bit more at the end as well. So is replication, at least in some cases, a misrepresentation of failure? That is, the notion that it's a crisis, that it's a bad thing, that it's a negative, and so forth. I should make clear, I guess, at this point that I want to make a distinction because it's maybe this comes up in a minute. I'll do this first. So this is a quote from Richard Feynman, of course, is famous for these sorts of things, and it's quite true. The first principle is that you must not fool yourself, and of course you are the easiest person to fool. And so this is why we accept replication as being important. But what's the legitimate role for replication failure in science to not fool yourself? And I think what I wanted to say earlier was that it's important to avoid conflating fraud and replication failure. I think Arthur did a wonderful job earlier of retraction issues, which include fraud and in some cases replication failures. But it's too often, I'm afraid, the two are conflated, especially, I must say, in the press. And often in the public mind, and that presents great dangers, I think, to the scientific effort and to the appreciation of science in the public mind, and it's wrong to do so. So I want to talk really just about replication failures and not fraud. And I think they can be distinguished, not always, sometimes they are fraud, but I'm not interested in those for this talk. So the question then is science broken? And we've sort of been through these now. This was the first of those articles, as Arturo pointed out, and it was called, characterized as a dismal 11% success rate, but that's these only 6 of 53 studies at sort of the leading edge of, I believe it was, cancer research that these two scientists, these two ex-scientists who ran Discovery at Amgen, found they could only get replication in that small number. So I would take issue with the word dismal to begin with. I'm not really sure that an 11% success rate is such a dismal thing when you're out at the frontier. I suspect if these guys went through the notebooks of their scientists at Amgen, they wouldn't find a success rate much higher than 11%. And by the way, all of the studies that they got for free. Because, well, they didn't get them for free. They got them for free. You all paid for them. And so I think it's the job of industry to go ahead and replicate and not to anticipate that anything that comes out of basic research in the academy is going to be perfect and they should just rely on it. It's not really a free lunch, as it were. That's one. Why most published research findings are false, of course, is John Ioannidis, but one of my favorite sort of quotes against that to some extent was John Maddox, the longtime, many decades editor of Nature, who died a few years ago, who was once asked by a journalist, how many papers in Nature do you think turn out to be wrong? And he immediately answered, oh, that's easy, all of them. Because that is presumably the case, and presumably should be the case, because, as I like to quote Charles Colson, the historian of science, in science, revision is a victory. And so we should recognize that sometimes this failure to replicate is actually an attempt at revision or an opportunity for revision. This is another one that we saw earlier, how science goes wrong. I sort of object to this only because it's on the front page of The Economist. It's a big blaring headline. The article, by the way, the authorship of the article is unknown. And there is within this article a great deal of conflation of ideas of fraud with replication failure and a definite disregard for telling those two things apart as part of the process of science. Let me use a historical example of a replication failure that was quite valuable. So this is a story about a scientist named Otto Loewi, who was an Austrian scientist, and the discovery of what he called vagus stuff at the time, but which we now know as acetylcholine. This was a sort of a dream experiment, goes back to 1921, and literally a dream experiment, because Loewi dreamed of this experiment. So there's a big question as to whether nerve cells, or nerve cells and the motor system, communicated with each other electrically or chemically. So there were synapses, people knew there were synapses between cells and these connections between cells, but was the communication from one neuron to the next neuron an electrical event, or was it a chemical event, or some combination of them? So Loewi had this dream of an experiment that would absolutely settle the issue, And he woke up the next morning, woke up from the dream, had this great dream, it was great, he went back to bed, he woke up from the dream, and he wrote it down. And then he went back to sleep again. He woke up the next morning to find that he could neither read what he had written down nor remember the dream. So you can imagine he was beside himself, and was so for about 3 weeks, so the story goes. And then he had this story is actually important, as you'll see in a minute, the details of it. As it happens, 3 weeks later, he had the dream again. This time, taking no chances at all, at 3 o'clock in the morning, he rushed to the laboratory in 1920s Vienna and did the experiment. Here's the experiment very quickly and simply, all right? So he took two frog hearts. He knows that the frog heart beats on its own. It has its own rate of beating, as does yours. That's why you can do heart transplants. But it also has a nerve supply, which will modulate the rate of the heart. And that nerve supply is, in particular in the frog, this vagus nerve up here. And the vagus nerve, when stimulated, he knew would slow down the beating of the heart. So he took two frog hearts, one which was still connected to a vagus nerve, and put it in a solution there, in a beaker, and another frog heart in a connected beaker, which was denervated, did not have the nerve supply. Then he stimulated the vagus nerve and indeed found that in heart one, it slowed down the beating rate. So the beating slowed down after he stimulated the vagus nerve. Shortly after that, the second heartbeat also began to slow down, proving, according to Loewi, and correctly in fact, that there was some substance being released by the nerves that was affecting the other heart, that was diffusing into the other chamber and slowing the other heart down as well, and that a direct electrical connection was not necessary. And so this settled the issue that it was in fact chemical communication rather than electrical communication, which is indeed true. In fact, he got a Nobel Prize for this work along with Henry Dale, a famous pharmacologist. The only problem is that this experiment could not be replicated either by Loewi or anybody else for almost 6 years, more than 6 years, in fact. Why couldn't it be replicated? Well, it turns out that the original experiments were performed in the winter and in the middle of the night in an unheated laboratory, because, of course, in those days they didn't heat the building all day long, they just turned the heat off. So it was quite cold in the laboratory, although he didn't care. It was up in the middle of the night, in the laboratory, in the middle of the night. Almost all of the replications were either done during the day in a warmed-up laboratory, a heated laboratory, or in warmer months. So there are two things that turn out to be important. Frogs are cold-blooded animals, and their physiology actually changes seasonally. And so the effect of acetylcholine on the frog heart is slightly different in the spring and summer than it is in the winter. More importantly is there's an enzyme called acetylcholine esterase that degrades acetylcholine. So shortly after it's released, it's also degraded because you don't want the signal hanging around forever. You want a new signal to be able to come in and tell the heart whether to continue beating fast or slow. But that the enzyme, the activity of this enzyme is significantly slowed in the cold temperatures, meaning there was a lot more acetylcholine available here to diffuse to this heart. Whereas in the warmer temperatures, much of it was broken down by the esterase, and so it couldn't get to the other heart, and therefore the experiment didn't work. This is all, by the way, laid out in a wonderful book called The War of the Soups and the Sparks. So the two competing ideas here were, whether it was chemical or electrical, they called themselves the soups and the sparks. And there was this went on for well over a decade, in fact. So the point is here that would anyone really have ever thought to put in their method section the month and the season and the time of day that they did the experiment? And the obvious answer, I think, is no. And so this is what I think is one of the difficulties in a replication failures is that there's some unknown unknown that simply hasn't been included in the methods. Not to be deceptive, not for fraudulent reasons, but simply because we didn't know that was important. So aside from the main result that came out of this, two other important unknowns came out of it, in fact, are things that we now know, which is enzymes are highly temperature dependent, which was not well understood at the time. And also that cold-blooded animals alter their physiology by season, which was also not well understood at the time. So that's, I think, an interesting story of a replication failure that turned out to be quite important, and important for several reasons. So replication, we think, is something that can be reproduced, is reliable. That is, if it's replicated, it is then reliable and believable. If something can't be replicated, it's considered unreliable, and we now call this the gold standard of science, although I was very interested in Yehuda's talk earlier, in which there was a long period of science in which there was no such thing as replication, but now it's the gold standard of science. So a great deal of science apparently was able to be done without its gold standard, as it turns out. I would say that the failure to replicate data does not mean that a result is in fact unreliable. That the failure to replicate is in many cases just like any other failure in science. It indicates that something's not been fully understood, that there's a variable that has gone unrecognized and unaccounted for, and it's an opportunity to make an even wider or larger discovery. There are a lot of reasons for failure to replicate. Of course, part of it is you could just be wrong. It could be partly wrong or partly right. It could be correct, but there's an inadequate experimental technique. Most often, I think we don't know, but we can indeed find out. So I think another crucial point here is that publication is not the conclusion of a process, it's an intermediate step. And this is one of the distortions in publication that I think Arturo sort of touched on, but I'd like to make very explicit. As he pointed out, one of the problems with the Nobel Prize often is that it stunts the growth of a field. You could say the same thing about a Nature paper. Once a Nature paper comes out about some result or some finding, that's it. You can't get any other graduate students to work in that area because the Nature paper is out. It's done. It's finished. And that's just not really the way science works or should work. So that's part of the problem. But we nonetheless continue to consider this idea of publication as somehow a conclusive end of a process when it really is just, I think, a progress report. As I said before, Charles Gillespie's famous statement that in science, revision is a victory. So let's talk about the scientific paper for a moment, since that's where the replication happens. This is a favorite little article of mine, at least, by Peter Medawar, who wrote this article for a public audience. Medawar, for those of you who don't know, is a wonderful Nobel Prize-winning immunologist, who was also sort of the Carl Sagan of the United Kingdom of Britain in his day, a very good friend of C.P. Snow of the two-world thing and all the rest of that. And Medawar was a wonderful spokesperson for science and had a wonderful ability to talk to the public about science. And he wrote this article in the Saturday Review called, "Is the Scientific Paper Fraudulent?" And he claimed yes, because it misrepresents scientific thought, which it of course does. The scientific paper in its orthodox form embodies a totally mistaken conception, even a travesty of the nature of scientific thought. Because of course, it never happens in the order in which you tell the narrative in the scientific paper. I hate to say this, maybe especially in this audience, but I can tell you that I, like many other people who run laboratories, have regularly said to students, well, let's get the data and then we'll work on the hypothesis, because that's typically the way it actually works. I always tell students, if you're reading a paper and at some point a paragraph begins with, we reason that, the rest of what you read is bullshit. It's not going to be the case. So, all right, so let's look particularly, though, at the methods section of papers, which I think don't get very much emphasis these days. It's sort of the throw-off part of it now. But, of course, this is where the replication problems often occur. So we're told, or we're taught, that the methods section of a paper should contain all the information necessary to repeat the experiments. I have to say that, in my opinion, that's total bullshit. That's just not actually the way it works. I think what you actually have is a situation where there's a great deal of what Michael Polanyi first identified and what the sociologist Harry Collins of the UK called tacit knowledge. And a great deal of this tacit knowledge goes into all of our work. The Harry Collins example is the TEA laser, which many of you may be familiar with. This was a new kind of a laser that was built by a lab. They published the blueprints for this thing. They published everything you need to know to build one. Another lab would try and build it and could not build it. Then they'd go to the lab where the TEA laser was built, and then they could build one. And then they could teach other people to build one, but nobody could build one unless you visited a lab that had already built one. But nobody ever knew why. Now you just buy them, so it's different. But that was the issue for a long time. There was some tacit knowledge, some set of unknown or what are sometimes called auxiliary variables that existed, which we could not actually put our finger on, these so-called unknown unknowns. So what I would say the methods section does do is it provides assurance to others in the field that for the experiments described, fairly standard accepted methods were used. If some unusual or exceptional new technology was used, then a thorough justification is required. So I would say the important thing here is that what a methods section tells you is that a paper should, in principle, be replicable. And I think replicability is the key issue in a scientific paper, not whether or not it is, in fact, ever replicated, but the ability to be replicated. The methods have to indicate the possibility of replication, that there wasn't anything mystical done here that we know of, there wasn't any secret sauce or anything of that nature. As this was a response, I think, to the Nosek paper, actually, this fellow Jeff Settleman said, and I think it's true, you give Julia Child and me the same recipe, you're not likely to get the same meal. And so just having the methods section is not likely to get you the same results. In general, my experience, and I think that of many other working scientists, is that there's a communicating author in the paper, and if you can't get what was working in that paper to work in your lab, you call them. I have in many cases sent a graduate student or a postdoc to another laboratory to see what the difference was, why they could get this result and we couldn't. And, you know, you find out all sorts of things, like the instruction to let the reaction proceed for 30 minutes before the next step actually turned out to be a coffee break. And it was not 30 minutes, in fact, or it varied in time depending on whether classes were in session or not, or what time of the day you did the experiment. So again, publication is not a conclusion, it's an intermediate step. I think replication failures should indeed be expected, and they should be expected perhaps at a fairly high rate, especially depending on the field. I think it's interesting that today we don't worry so much about replication failures in physics and chemistry, but there were many, historically speaking, when they were younger fields, and there were more unknown unknowns. Now we have what I would call the truly hard sciences, which is psychology and sociology and systems biology, where there are yet vast unknown unknowns and incredibly complex systems where it's very hard to know what all the unknowns are and what all the variables are. And so I would expect replication failure to be quite high in these areas. Yes, that's what that says. Also, I think one of the important things that we often forget that is especially in biology and psychology and the social sciences, noise is the data. So an awful lot of statistical techniques or analytical techniques have been developed to get rid of noise, essentially, to get the data out of the noise. But in biology, variability and noise is often the data. And so we're using, in many cases, I think, the wrong instruments. I don't know what the right instruments are, but I think we're using the wrong instruments, as Deborah sort of pointed out. So, yeah, So this is sort of an intermediate slide, which I suggest that we should go on and have more of these failures. I like to call them debacles because the current usage, of course, is an unmitigated disaster or a total failure. But actually, the word has an interesting etymology. It comes from the French débâcle, which means to free, to unbar, or to unleash. Its original usage was as a nautical term for ice breaking. The idea that you would break a path through a solid sheet of ice, you could break a new path through it. So when you think about creativity or innovation, well, we always think it arises by interdisciplinary things and associating ideas, but actually it could be more often that it's from dissociating ideas that have been too long associated. An idea that was developed, I would say, by this philosopher, Ortega y Gasset, the Spanish philosopher, in a really interesting book called The Revolt of the Masses, that I don't know whether it gets read much more or not, but it costs more to dissociate ideas than to associate them. And I think it's interesting that we still today use the word for a great discovery, we still call it a breakthrough somehow or another. So I think we should break a few more things, probably, is the thing to do. So I would say rather than a crisis of failure, replication failure, we actually find ourselves in some ways in a crisis of success. I'm not going to go through this in too much detail because I think Arturo already did too good a job of this. But these crises of success include things like education, where we teach science, we didn't talk too much about this, but we teach science as a set of facts that one memorizes, what I call the bulimic model of science education, where we cram a lot of facts down kids' throats and they puke them up on some exam that's standardized and they move on to the next unit with very little gain of any sort, I think. But we teach this sort of arc of discovery kind of science in which there are no failures, in which you get from, you know, Copernicus to Kepler to Newton, Galileo, I don't know, Faraday, set of Maxwell, Einstein, blah, 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 physics. Wow, that's fabulous, right? And we never really talk much about all the failures, the cul-de-sacs, the wrong turns, the inability to keep experiments, to replicate experiments, and so forth and so on, that went on throughout the history of all of these things. And so I think one of the problems with this worry about replication failures is that we teach people to worry about this. We teach people that science is nothing but settled fact. That once you read it in a textbook, once you read it in a paper, it's settled, it's done, it's stone, count on it. It's just, we all should know, not the case. Funding, of course, is always, this is a problem that I think Arthur did an extremely good job of discussing, but I will point out just one little fact about it that's one of my favorites. We tend not to fund failure. The NIH, the NSF now, especially with their very low pay lines, all they want is to fund success. That's a bad idea because failure is not just, I want to point out that failure in science for me is not important only retrospectively. Failure is not important because at some point it leads to success or it teaches you perseverance or any of those other sort of self-helpy kinds of things. Science, a failure, I believe, is woven into the very fabric of science. It doesn't matter whether it eventually becomes successful. If you're not failing sufficiently, then you're not really doing probably very interesting or useful science. So NIH sort of recognizes this. They have this, and NSF has a similar thing. NIH has a thing called high risk, high reward grants. So very risky, likely to fail, but if it succeeds, it would be tremendously rewarding. It would be transformative. I think they call it an NSF. That's fabulous. That was last year, the last several years, has been about 1.5% of the NIH research budget. So the question I ask is, does that mean that 98.5% of the research budget is going into incremental crap that nobody gives a damn about? Because if that is, that's a terrible waste. That's a terrible, terrible waste. And I do believe that's often the case. I was told by Sidney Brenner, a famous molecular biologist, Nobel Prize winner, who's English or Australian, South African originally, but works in Cambridge. He said, yes, well, the thing about an NIH grant is it comes in two parts. In the first part are all the experiments you've already done, and in the second part are all the experiments you're never going to do. And that's how you write an NIH grant, right? But this is clearly a distorted way of doing it, right? And leads to problems with replication, fraud, and all these other distorted incentives. Publication, of course, there are all the problems that we talked about, as well as the failure to publish negative results, the failure to have a forum for citable. I believe the critical thing is citable negative results. I think there's a solution to this problem because we have this internet thing now. I mean, it was more difficult when it was a publication issue, but one could imagine a website where negative results could be posted in a citable way. So I think it's crucial that they gain a citation, because that's part of the reward system and it's what we're left with at the moment. And they could be very short and they could be lightly reviewed and they could just be up there. There's always a problem with negative results because you don't know whether the negative result came from somebody's inadequacy or inability or a real negative result. But if several people post the same negative result having tried this, well then you can begin to consider it more reliable as a negative result. I also think it would be a great database for future historians of science. Finally, there's the evaluation issue, of course, which distorts incentives all over the place. And that's a very difficult one to work on because it starts way at the top and works its way down. So I don't really care whether my laboratory publishes a paper in Science or Nature, but if a graduate student comes to me and says, wow, I think maybe this could go into science, I recognize that this could make a huge difference in their career. And even if I think it only has a half-assed chance of getting into science, I'm willing to do that because it'll make such a difference for them. And so this has to really be improved at the top. It can't be improved from the bottom, in my opinion, at least. So I'm going to leave you with this, what I think is a really optimistic and nice view of science, but one that we need to support more, and that's this notion of night science that the molecular biologist, geneticist François Jacob wrote in one of his many really beautiful books. He says, night science is a science that hesitates, stumbles, recoils, sweats, wakes with a start, doubting everything, a sort of workshop of the possible, where thought makes its way along meandering paths and twisting lanes, most often leading nowhere. Excuse me, and I think without night science, the day science just won't ever be as good. So I'll end with this quote from Rita Dove, who was our poet laureate for a couple of years. Failure is a favor to the future. And I think we should think of it that way. And similarly from James Joyce, mistakes are the portals.